Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
It's Straight Out of Cobham, a show about Chelsea FC from The Athletic. Coming up, cup dreams continue as Blues beat Preston in the West End. We'll talk debutants sharing the goal-scoring load and a sterling free kick. There's a League Cup semi-final preview as Chelsea sup from the Cup of Carabao. But obviously, it's not all good news. Chelsea, innit? Sam Kerr, Nenac setback. Available for free wherever you get your podcasts and ad-free on The Athletic. This is Straight Out of Cobham. I did consider starting this podcast with just a series of expletives when I saw that news about Sam Kerr, but that's not the way we want to kick off our week, is it, listeners? So let's just say good morning to everybody, but especially Michael Golding and his adorable smile and little handshake for the fourth official as he was about to enter the pitch. Truly a moment of FA Cup magic. It's me, Matt, and I'm back here with two of The Athletic's finest. Hello, Dominic Fifield.
Good morning, Matthew. How are you?
I can't smile wide enough. You know my disposition. Liam Toomey's back with us too. You all right, Liam?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm still waiting to find out if I can get that half hour of my life back that I lost waiting to find out if Enzo Fernandez's goal would be allowed.
Yeah, it was important though, wasn't it? Because, you know, the game was really on a knife edge at that point. So we needed those 8 minutes of stoppage time at the end as well. Good old VAR. I bet everybody enjoyed the FA Cup games this weekend. They didn't have it, but Chelsea's did. And they won it comfortably. That's where we're going to start today.
Here comes the second corner. Oh, Breyer's broken the deadlock.
Oh, well attacked as well and powered in by Thiago Silva at the near post. Sterling, oh, brilliant. Delicate, effortless quality. Raheem Sterling with a free kick that he pulls from the top draw.
Moises Caicedo very rarely shoots. Back to Sterling, wriggles into the gap. Will it come here? Surely offside, Enzo Fernandez, flagger, won't count. And the goal will be given. And Chelsea are 4-0 up.
We didn't match them in the energy and they decided to play. That is why we were so sloppy and that is why we didn't control the game in the way that we wanted. I think we create a few chances and we concede maybe the similar chances, but I think I was disappointed. The players were disappointed. And then when we increase and we start to play in the way that we wanted to play, I think we control the game, we start to create chances and score the goals and win the game.
Right, so Preston's cup hopes north-ended by Chelsea then. A 4-0 win for the Blues on Saturday night. It means Potter's peeps are in the hat for round four. The draw for which is being made after we record, but still hopefully Chelsea will be able to get the job done against, I don't know, let's say Sheffield Wednesday at home. Anyway, back to Saturday. Kind of reverse Sven, I thought, Liam. First half bad, second half not so bad.
First half was dire. Don might have something to add on that, just how bad the first half was.
It was horribly pedestrian, wasn't it? Let's be honest. I'll make an admission here. I watched the first half. In fact, I watched up until, well, probably about the 55th minute, something like that. I was listening to the pundits on the television tell me that Armando Broya was just needed to do more and wasn't offering enough and wasn't moving enough and wasn't being dynamic enough. And then, quite frankly, it was so tedious that and yet so inevitable that Chelsea would win the game, but ultimately, that I went to the cinema.
What did you see?
One Life, which is unbelievable, by the way. And I've never blubbed my way through a film, the entirety of a film before. But I'm pathetic. Maybe that was the effect of the Chelsea performance prior to that, possibly. I don't know.
Blubbed my way through a few Chelsea games in the last 2 years. But the first half was really, really poor. And that was pretty much what Pochettino said afterwards. You could tell that he was genuinely annoyed by what he'd seen, particularly when you look at the team that he'd picked. You know, he made only four changes from the Luton win, and Alfie Gilchrist's debut masked the fact that it was pretty much a Premier League team that he selected to face Preston, because he wanted to send the message that this game mattered. And that more generally, as I wrote afterwards, the Cups really matter to Chelsea right now, because the league isn't offering a whole lot to them. And the performance from the players really didn't reflect that. It didn't seem like that message had gotten through from the first whistle. They didn't impose themselves. They allowed, in a lot of ways, Preston to dictate the game. And it was one of those in the stadium, I've been to enough of them at this point, quite a flat early round cup atmosphere where the crowd are waiting for the team to get them going. And in that situation, if the team are also waiting for the crowd to get them going, it's a recipe for a very slow first half performance. I mean, they never looked in serious danger of going 1-0 down, but they did allow Preston far too much joy with those long balls, little flick-ons. A lot seemed to be going behind Chelsea's defence. And then, they got a grip of themselves in the second half, but it was slightly alarming in the first half, given the amount of talent and, as many people have written, the amount of money they had on the pitch in those opening 45 minutes, just how little control they had over things.
I guess in a way, Dom, there's some kind of comfort that I take in the fact that elite teams do this. And, you know, I wouldn't put Watford in the elite team category, but I noticed the Athletic's Adam Leventhal tweeting during their game against Chesterfield about how unprofessional sloppy their approach to that game was as they were losing. I saw Forest go 2-0 down against Blackpool on Sunday as well. And we talk a lot about elite level athletes and their mentality, but it's clearly a thing, isn't it, that players can still go onto a pitch and think, well, we're better than these, so we can play at 70% and we'll still win the game anyway.
Yeah, a combination of that and the opposing team being up for it in the old phrase and wanting to prove that they can compete at that level. I mean, you see this to a certain extent when there's a team promoted to the Premier League as well, possibly. It takes a while for players to adjust to the levels, et cetera, and impose themselves. I watched that game. The best part of the first half by far was played by, I think, Will Keane for Preston, a wonderful little dink in behind Chelsea. But that's the type of pass that Chelsea needs to be making to unlock Preston's defence. And there was no urgency. That they just, it looked as if there was a complacency there, a sort of, well, we'll prevail ultimately, you know, at the end of the game, we'll have done enough. And, you know, they did. It's still a 4-0 win at the end of the day, but I can see why it's so infuriating for Pochettino, because those players are clearly, and they showed it in the second half, but they're clearly better and capable of more than they mustered in that first half. But I think it's rather indicative of the way Chelsea have been playing of late. I mean, in all those wins that they've had, I think it's 4 and 5, isn't it? There have been periods where they've been distinctly unimpressive, but other periods where they've actually looked fantastic and really cut the opponents to shreds. So that's just where Chelsea are. It's indicative of the inconsistency within this group.
Some pretty strong criticism that did the rounds over the weekend on Maurizio Pochettino, specifically from Julian Laurens of ESPN and elsewhere. Liam, how much of Chelsea's inconsistency and lethargy are you pinning on Poch, and how much of it is due to the immaturity/inexperience of the team?
I know that Pochettino has been criticised not just from Julian Laurent, but by quite a lot of Chelsea fans online in the last few weeks for some of his selection decisions, for the kind of tactical plan, or in some people's eyes, lack thereof. I personally have always seen what Chelsea are trying to do, which for me has been the fundamental contrast between this season and last. Whether it's been working or not has varied, and how well it's been executed has varied wildly in some of these games. But it's always been clear what Pochettino has been trying to get this team to do. The system has been very consistent. The way they try to play, kind of luring teams upfield, playing out from the back, which I know a lot of fans still are deeply uncomfortable with, and then springing forward, playing through pressure. You know, all of those things have been pretty consistent, I think. And so I think I am naturally more inclined to look at the players individually, you know, lacking experience, consistency, and as we've mentioned, in a game like that, maybe showcasing their inexperience of not recognising initially what Dom was talking about, that this would be Preston's cup final and that they would need to, you know, at least be semi up for it in the opening 45 minutes. And partly because the combinations keep changing on the pitch with injuries and suspensions and other circumstances. I think we have seen flashes, particularly as I think as Christopher Nkunku has started to be reassimilated. And of course, he's had a setback because this is Chelsea. Why wouldn't he have had a setback? You know, I think we've started to see more of the rattling one-touch passing in the middle and attacking thirds that we saw in pre-season and then just kind of vanished once Pochettino had to shake that half of the team up again. I think in time we will begin to see more of the patterns of play will become more obvious. I understand the criticism right now, but I don't really think that first half was on Pochettino. And the one other thing to mention is that I think when you're looking at Chelsea's attacking play and that they don't get anything from the fullback positions. I know that was something Julian Laurent mentioned, partly because they don't have any fullbacks. Like Malo Gusto has really stood out in the last couple of weeks because he's the only fit fullback at the club and he's having to play quite well. And I think, you know, Pochettino said after the game, Chilwell is one of the players who's getting close to coming back. That's massive because it's so important to the way he wants to play and so important to the way modern elite teams try to play, to have some attacking thrust from those fullback positions. And Chelsea will look completely different with that.
Mm, yeah, it's massive if he can come back and stay back, I guess, is the key. Alfie Gilchrist did pretty well on his first start. Lasted for about an hour, but I think probably the most relieved man, Dom, was Armando Breuer. Really important for him to get the goal because we know he's going to now have this extended run with Jackson at AFCON and Kunku out for a couple of weeks with a hip problem. And as basic as it is, this is what he's going to be judged on, right? He can do all the nice hold-up play that he likes. He can bring others in. He can make good runs off the ball, but he's got to score goals. And he didn't get any chances at all in the first half. So when one did come his way, really good to see that he could actually bury it. And Poch talked about him playing with a smile rather than, you know, wearing his worries on his shoulders kind of thing. And you could see the difference it made.
Absolutely. He does betray his mood with his body language, Breuer. There were times in that first half when he was peripheral and he was isolated, you know, the shoulders slumped and he just looked, he has that sort of languid style to him and his running. He's not like all action, is he? He's so I think when you have that and the ball isn't getting to you and you're feeling a bit isolated, it just transmits poorly. And I think that's what Pochettino was getting at with his post-match comments. But lovely, deft little header. He repeated the trick a few minutes later and hit the woodwork. Simon wrote a nice piece on Friday last week about the importance of this little period for Breuer and how he has to capitalise on Nicholas Jackson's absence. But, you know, even when Jackson comes back, it's really only Breuer and Jackson who would be arguably, you know, natural number nines within this Chelsea squad. It seems unlikely now that Chelsea will sign somebody for massive money in this window. So for confidence, his confidence, to feel he belongs, to build on those little cameo performances from the autumn, I mean, the impact that he made in the Fulham match, the impact that he made against Manchester City in winning the late penalty, to provide that on a more consistent basis in the Premier League and the FA Cup, possibly the League Cup as well. I mean, that is critical for Breuer to show that he belongs at this level and to show that he should be in contention for first-team recognition next season as well.
Can I just give a a very short insight into the plight of the matchday reporter, particularly one that's sharing responsibilities on a beat, because usually me and Simon Johnson are magnificently in sync in what we write and what we don't write. We don't tread on each other's toes. But there I was, sitting in the Stamford Bridge press box thinking, right, yeah, nice easy piece, Alfie Gilchrist's debut. Let's watch him, see how he gets on. Then I get a message from Simon. Oh, we've written about him recently. Might be writing about him again soon. Please steer clear of Alfie. Okay, fine. Then Armando Breuer scores. Right, nice easy piece. I think this is a really important stretch of time for him with Jackson going off to the African Cup of Nations, and then realise that Simon has published that exact piece the day before the game.
That may be down to brilliant editing or very, very poor
editing. It might be.
One of the two.
Or just incredible Simon Johnson's incredible prescience, which has been referenced before. But yeah, so I was scrambling around by the end to find something of note to write about a 4-0 win. And if anyone has any issues with my match piece, please direct any complaints to Simon Johnson.
Athletic.com/ChelseaPod. The place to go, by the way, if you want to sign up and read Liam's match piece. So Breuer got his goal, another plucky youngster. Can you be a youngster? Maybe. Thiago Silva, 39 years old. His first, I love this, first appearance in the FA Cup third round. He'd never deigned to feature in the competition before the quarterfinal stage, before Saturday. But he comes on, nods in from Cole Palmer's corner to make it 2-0. Looked like he really enjoyed it too. Interesting quotes here, Liam, from Maurizio Pochettino on Palmer, who registered his 15th goal involvement in 20 games this season. Poch said, today a little bit disappointed with him because he didn't score a big chance he has. He's still young and needs to improve in different areas, not only inside the pitch, but outside. What could he mean by that?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the outside the pitch thing, and don't want to speculate. But we've got the impression with Palmer, and I think it's been a key aspect of him being able to come in and hit the ground running at Chelsea in a positive way. He's a very confident guy. I think it's why he wasn't prepared to sit on the fringes at City, even considering how great that squad is. He felt that he could come to Chelsea and be the man. And he's shown in his first few games that I think he's got the capability of doing that on a consistent basis. But maybe Pochettino has looked at him and thought, you're the kind of personality that needs to be brought down occasionally rather than built up. And that's what that comment struck me as. I think it was just Pochettino making a judgment call in terms of man management there. And I think he's done that a couple of times with Palmer, maybe less explicitly, of just like, you know, yeah, he's doing well, but he's still got more to work on. And basically don't think you've cracked this yet as well as you're playing. And I do think that's broadly fair as well, because as supremely talented as Palmer looks and as well as he's played, I think there's still an impression that he's kind of scratching the surface of the player he can ultimately be, which, given his age, is completely understandable. So I think Pochettino's just trying to make sure that he keeps pushing to reach those levels, game in and game out.
All right, so it's Jose-like treatment then. Dom, is Raheem Sterling off the naughty step now? There was the pass that wasn't at Wolves, followed by the yellow card that meant he got a suspension, and then he wasn't picked for the next game against Luton, but that free kick was a decent way to make amends.
Free kick was magnificent. Still aspects of his performance that are a bit frustrating. I think he's one of the senior men in this team, and you know, in that first half, when things were ambling and Chelsea weren't really grabbing the game properly, you'd look to him as one of the senior players on the pitch to actually wrest some control and impose the quality on Championship opposition, and it just didn't happen. So we all know that the quality is there with Raheem, and it's a matter of coaxing it out, and the free kick did that fantastically well. But I still look at him and think, there's more there, and Chelsea should be probably seeing a bit more of it on a more consistent basis.
Yeah, agreed. I'd say the same about Enzo Fernandez, Liam. I was quite surprised to see him in the team, given the nature of what we thought his injury was. But he looked relatively fit. He got his goal as well. Do we think that he's back to full fitness and back to the Enzo who cannot be dropped and will start every game from now until the end of the season?
It's hard to say, because he still doesn't look like, I mean, he's not an explosive athlete, but he doesn't He still doesn't look like he's moving at 100% to me. He did play, I thought, the best Chelsea pass of the first half, and Dom's already handed out that award for the match to Will Keane, but his floated ball through for Palmer would have been a fantastic goal that Chelsea probably didn't deserve at the time, that he dinked just wide. That, you know, that was a classic Enzo pass, and maybe the kind of thing that we've seen a little bit too rarely from him in recent weeks. It's just so difficult, I think, with him, just given the way he moves naturally, to assess whether he's carrying something or not. And if he is, then, yeah, it's a bit risky for Chelsea to keep playing him. I think he's been overexposed, certainly in the first half of this season, because of Romeo Lavia's unavailability. I think Lavia would be the Enzo replacement slash reliever in this squad if he were healthy, but he just hasn't been available. So instead, it's been a continuation for Enzo of the second half of last season, where he played every minute of every game, it felt like, or at least started every game, regardless of whether that game mattered or not. So he does at some point, I think, need to be rotated in and out. But the fact that he started this game, I think, further underlined what we mentioned, was just how seriously Pochettino was approaching it and how determined he was to make sure that there were no slips and that Chelsea were in the hat for the fourth round.
Well, it was a good day for the hashtag buy Neil Bath a pint movement, with Alfie Gilchrist starting, Levi Colwill captain, Armando Breuer scoring, and Michael Golding and David Washington coming off the bench. This was quite an easy win for Poch in that regard, Dom, I think, wasn't it? Because as soon as the second and third goal goes in, you know, there's no doubt about the outcome of the game. And Golding even could have scored, actually. But does that quieten down the questions for Poch about why he hasn't turned to the academy so much? I mean, he's kind of ticked the box now, right? There's not really going to be an appropriate game to do it in again, unless Chelsea get drawn at home to lower league opponents in round four.
Which is inevitable.
Yeah.
I don't know. To be fair, it's a minute or two at the end of the game. I mean, I'm not sure it's going to silence that debate. I'm not sure either about the validity of the debate, to be honest. I know the goalkeepers on the bench thing has cropped up, indeed was mentioned, discussed on the pod last week as well. But I don't know. I'm uneasy with the whole academy stuff at the moment because of the phrase that Liam coins in every single piece he writes about pure profit and the FFP and profit and sustainability rules, etc., and what the academy actually means for Chelsea and this ownership on a practical level. I suspect that to that end, the debate will rage on, certainly until the end of the January transfer window and possibly through the summer window as well, because it may be that Chelsea fans are just going to have to get used to seeing academy graduates sold rather than academy graduates blooded in the first team and established as regulars under Pochettino at senior level. I'm not comfortable with that at all, to be honest, but it's nothing to do with me. I'm completely impartial on that front, but I can understand why it makes some Chelsea supporters uneasy.
What I will say is that virtually from the moment the third Chelsea goal went in, there were frustrations with how slow Pochettino was to get some of the academy boys off the bench and give those debuts. I think there were frustrations that David Washington was the first one to come on, that Michael Golding got so little time, and that Dylan Williams didn't get on at all. But I think the counterbalance to that is that Alfie Gilchrist's start was a real start, I think, because of the team Pochettino picked. You know, he wasn't part of some patchwork cup selection, which you often see in games like this, where it can affect the nature of the match itself. As it was only Chelsea's performance that did that in the first half. But the selection showed that Pochettino was taking it seriously. And within that context, I think Gilchrist getting a start at right back was a real reflection of what Pochettino thinks of him. Now, it's clearly still not his best position at youth level, which is centre-back, but Chelsea only have centre-backs fit at the moment in defence. So some of them have to play full-back, and I think Gilchrist was the natural choice on this occasion. But that was those were real minutes and not an opportunity to be sniffed at.
It's a good grounding, isn't it, for a young centre half to play at fullback and get involved in that way in the first team, I think. So
just ask Levi Colwill.
Exactly.
Or Andreas Christensen, right? That's it. He did it at Shrewsbury on his debut.
But I wondered whether, I mean, when we were talking about this prior to Saturday, Simon and I, the suggestion was that Gilchrist might have played at left back and that Gusto would have then been playing in his natural position. And I know he set up the goal cutting back inside and crossing, but I think it takes something away from Chelsea if the right back, who's your one fullback, as Liam says, who's playing in his natural position, isn't doing things on the outside. I just wondered whether, I mean, Liam, whether you thought that Gilchrist might swap over to the left back in times of need. I'm not saying this midweek, because I think Colwill will probably play there at the Riverside, but is that an option that they could explore if Chilwell needs a bit of time?
There was an interesting conversation that we had just after the team news dropped at Stamford Bridge about whether you ask a young player to adapt and compromise just to get minutes in the team, or whether you ask a more experienced head. And it feels weird to be referring to Malo Gusto as a more experienced head in it, but in this conversation, it makes sense, at least, by playing in an unfamiliar position. And Gilchrist was already playing in a slightly less familiar position at fullback. So to play him at left back, I'm sure he would have thrown himself into it like he has with everything, but maybe Pochettino's calculation was, you know, Gusto's had real Premier League experience playing on the left as well as the right, and he'll more easily be able to adapt to that. But I do go back to what I said before. Chelsea will continue to struggle for consistent attacking fluency if they're not getting anything from those fullback positions going forward, at least one of them. You know, in pre-season, Pochettino basically picked one to hair upfield and the other one sat back. And we're seeing a lot of this asymmetrical style of back fours with, you know, inverted wing backs and all this stuff at the top of the Premier League. But you do need the potential for overloads and these little wide passing triangles on one side of the pitch, at least. And Chelsea, when they play their four centre-back alignment, just don't get that at all. So to go back to Gilchrist, I think he will continue to get opportunities, probably largely from the bench, as like a intense reliever in the way that he was against Crystal Palace, just to bring a bit of fresh energy in the closing minutes. But it probably will continue to come at fullback and be more situational when Chelsea don't need as much going forward.
All right, well, we'll see if he features against Middlesbrough on Tuesday night. No let-up in the cup football for Chelsea this month. We're going to look ahead to the first leg of the League Cup semi next.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Well, luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Championship opposition again for Chelsea then, as they head to the Riverside Stadium for the first time in, well, actually not that long, March 2022, the Blues facing Middlesbrough in the first leg of the Carabao Cup semi-final. Harry says, with some tricky Prem games coming up, do we go full strength in the first leg against Borough and get a good win to then rest key players at home for the second leg, which is ahead of the big game against Liverpool? Liam, we're likely to see what we saw against Preston, aren't we, in that the starting 11 will be strong as possible, with the option to kind of change things if and when Chelsea take the lead. So is that, as Dom suggests, Colwill back to left back, Gusto right back, and Thiago Silva coming in, for example? Maybe Madueke in for Mudryk, who had one of those games on Saturday.
Yeah, we saw four changes from Luton to Preston, didn't we? I think probably that number again, maximum for this game. And Silva is probably one of the guys who will come back in, given that in most intense situations, and I think the Riverside will be intimidating at the very least, because their fans will try to make it so. For Chelsea, they realise that game is their big chance in this tie. Pochettino has tended to lean on Silva in those situations, so I'd be very surprised if he doesn't come back in with Colwell going to left back. And also because you might be expecting Middlesbrough, as is the case with quite a few lower league teams when they play Chelsea, will try and target them at set pieces and with long balls. And if you have Colwell at left back, you have that bit of extra height. Even if he's not, you know, John Terry in the air, I think he's pretty good in the air, and he's a big body that can help. So, yeah, I think Pochettino will go strong, partly because he doesn't actually have a ton of options when you consider the number of players that are still injured. After the game, I asked Pochettino about the injury situation, and he did say he did name check Chilwell, Chukwuemeka and Badiashile as three players who are so close, in his words, to being back. I don't expect any of them are in the conversation to start this game. They might make the bench at best. So in terms of the core of players that will be in consideration for that 11, I think we're still talking about 13, 14 names.
Alan says, are Borough any good these days? Well, they're 12th in the championship. They're 4 points off the playoffs. They were beaten in the semis of the playoffs last season. Michael Carrick's an interesting one, isn't he, Dom? He's clearly got something about him, but they're coming into this game having managed just one shot on target at home to Villa on Saturday. As Liam says, this is effectively the tie for them, isn't it? If they need to either have a narrow defeat, a draw, or if they can get a lead going into the second leg. So you'd expect them to approach this game with more of a mind towards attack than defence?
I think they'll approach it knowing that Chelsea are, although they've had a picked up in terms of results recently, but there has been a vulnerability at Stamford Bridge as well in the last year. So I don't think it certainly won't be as daunted as a championship team would have been in the past. They've done brilliantly well to get to this far in the competition. Nice draw in the previous round, admittedly, at League One Port Vale. But I look at Borough and I think they sort of epitomise the championship. You know, semi-finalists last year in the playoffs, don't win any of their first seven games of the new campaign, then have an incredible run that gets them back into contention, and then complete inconsistency takes over again, where they have these streaks of defeats and then a flurry of victories. The last four games in the league have completely summed it up, where they beat West Brom, who were challenging, they beat them just before Christmas, think they're going to kick on from that, and then proceed to lose at Rotherham, who were bottom, then beat Huddersfield in an away game, and then get hammered at home by Coventry. So, I mean, he must be tearing his hair out, but that is the nature of the division, I suppose.
Is this your long-winded way of implying that Chelsea are like a championship side? The inconsistency?
Actually, I hadn't thought of it like that, but they're not, though, are they? Because Chelsea have won 4 out of 5. I mean, some of the performances have been inconsistent, but the results haven't been particularly of late.
They're on a hot streak.
Well, this is about as hot as it comes these days, isn't it? Borough will, yeah, they will try and whip it up into a frenzy on Tuesday night. But whether this lot can, I just look at them and think, well, are they likely to actually, I don't know, impose themselves on a team that includes people like Thiago Silva in it? Probably not. Over two legs, you'd expect Chelsea to progress into a final. And that actually is really encouraging for Pochettino in what has been a difficult first season. There's a chance for a Wembley final here.
Yeah, and they'll look to prey on Middlesbrough's pretty iffy home form. Lost three of their last four, yeah. Actually four of their last five at the Riverside. So it's not as if they've been blowing teams away on their own patch. They've got loads of injury problems as well at the moment. Have Middlesbrough. So this is all set up nicely by me for a 2-0 win for the home side, especially given that I'm going there to watch it. Liam, give me a prediction. What's the score going to be in this game? We haven't done that for a while.
Liam, why don't you make yourself a fool ahead of kickoff? I do think it's going to be a, it's probably going to be a close, quite uncomfortable game for a young Chelsea team in spells, but I'm going to go for 2-0. A late breakaway goal, second goal, making it look more comfortable than it is.
What about you, Dom? Emmanuel Latte-Lath is going to be playing. Will it be a flat white of a game in the snow up there in Middlesbrough?
That's just awful. That's awful.
I know. I was thinking mocha cappuccino flat white. It doesn't really work, but I just literally just saw his name and thought, I can't not do some sort of coffee pun. It's not possible.
I feel dirty. Chelsea will win. I just think they've got they've clearly got better players. I think we sometimes forget the gulf between even mid-table Premier League teams when they turn it on and even those at near the top of the Championship, especially over two legs, they will get through to Wembley. But there might be some uncomfortable moments at the Riverside, but I still think Chelsea will win the match.
All right. If I had my time again, I would have probably gone semi-skimmed Latte-Lath because it's a semi-final. But hey, you know, there's a second leg. I'll work on it, listener, and come up with something better. And I'm sorry.
I think you've literally just had your time again. I think that's what that was.
Whatever happens at the Riverside, we will react to it on our Thursday show. Bad news comes next.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
You've probably heard by now, listener, but if I'm just breaking it to you for the first time, set your face to stun. Sam Kerr has done her ACL. This is like the worst thing that could possibly have happened to the Chelsea women's team. It means we've got to throw up the bat signal, though, and here from our Jesse Parker-Humphreys, who sent us this voice note on the news.
Obviously, Chelsea fans have been spending the past 24 hours digesting the news that Sam Kerr has suffered an ACL injury. A pretty catastrophic announcement from the club there happened on their warm weather training camp in Morocco. And something I think Chelsea will be particularly disappointed with, given that over the past couple of years they've begun to see themselves as real leaders in terms of being very aware of the risks of ACL injury and having done very well in terms of preventing them among the squad. Kerr obviously has suffered serious knee injuries in the past as well, which only adds to the further disappointment of her getting this one and being out for realistically a year. And the impact really can't be overstated. Kerr is probably the one truly irreplaceable player within the Chelsea squad. That's the reality when you've got someone who's sort of in the top five players in the world in your team. There are a couple of different elements, I think, of her absence and how that will affect the team going forward. Firstly, I think in terms of sort of personality and leadership, people will look at the goal scoring and obviously that is an important aspect. But Millie Bright, Chelsea's captain, has been out for a while with her own sort of knee injury complications. We're not sure when she'll be back. And in her absence, Kerr has been the player who stepped up and taken the armband. So Chelsea now looking at having their captain and vice captain out. But of course, the goals are an important part of Kerr's game. She doesn't score necessarily in the same volume that she did earlier in her Chelsea career. You know, if you look two seasons or so ago, she was scoring about a third of their goals in the league. That's now gone down to more like 20%. But really, it's the clutch element of the way she plays that I think we really missed. You regularly see her popping up with incredibly important goals. She's scored a number of times for them in FA Cup finals. She's got them over the line in league games where they haven't played very well. And there'll be a lot of pressure on Mia Fischel, who was signed in the summer for £250,000, definitely as a development prospect, who will now be stepping up into this starting striker role. Pressure also on the returning Kat Macario, who's coming back from her own ACL injury, which she suffered at Lyon. Chelsea obviously bought her while she was still recuperating, but she's been out for 18 months with hers at this point, which just shows you how devastating an injury this can be. And I think the last thing Chelsea will have wanted is to sort of have pressure put on her. You know, with Kerr available, there was the opportunity for Macario to gradually work her way in the team. She can play as a 9 or as a 10. And now you wonder whether Chelsea will be keener to sort of push her up the pecking order quicker. But even looking beyond those striking options that Chelsea have in Fischel and Macario, I think they will also be looking to players like Frank Kirby, like Guru Wrighton, to bring that experience now as the season goes on, both in terms of that goal-scoring element and that mentality element. We know Chelsea do have a lot of different goal scorers available to them, and they've shown that they have the most goal scorers in the WSL at the moment. But it's very, very hard to replace exactly what Kerr does. There is obviously the potential of looking to the transfer market. Again, when you've got a player like her, it's not easy to go out and buy someone just like her. In fact, I think it's impossible to go out and do that. The one thing you wonder is whether they will look to bring in maybe a younger player, someone who can support Fischel and Macario as sort of an extra body for minutes, rather than someone, you know, going for like a Hegerberg or something who does only have 6 months left on her contract, because then you have the problem of what happens when Kerr returns. Although she is out of contract at the end of the season, but I think all signs were pointing to expecting her to sign a new deal if she hasn't already. Obviously, what impact this injury might have on that, we don't know. I think actually one of the saddest things about this whole situation is it means that we've watched Sam Kerr play her last Chelsea game under Emma Hayes. And Hayes and Kerr are obviously two personalities, I think, who've really connected, who've helped bring the best out of each other. I think Kerr has been someone who's helped Hayes' team become that really dominant domestic force that we've seen Chelsea be over the past couple of years. And obviously with her departure to the US national team at the end of this season, that means we've seen the end of that. And I think for it to come in this sort of unexpected way, it is obviously very, very devastating for the whole squad. I think they still have the ability to pull themselves together, to be able to move forward as a group and to still be a threat both domestically and in the Champions League. I think Chelsea and Hayes are a team and manager who sometimes really rally when things go against them, but it's impossible to overstate how devastating a blow this will be for Chelsea's hopes for the rest of the season.
Liam, there's no way of sugarcoating this. This is just a dreadful thing to happen to the Chelsea women's team, unfortunately. She's got the second best minutes per goal ratio in WSL history. She's got 58 and 75 in the competition. She's been captain, actually, hasn't she, more often than not, of the team this season. Does this mean that Chelsea go into the transfer market this month to try and replace her, or are they going to be relying on Lauren James, Frank Kirby, Aggie Beaver-Jones, Mia Fischel to step up and provide the goals?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating question, and one that Chelsea weren't expecting to be facing. At the moment, on the women's side, I think they're preoccupied with the question of who comes after Emma Hayes. Never mind questions of this significance on the pitch. I mean, that doesn't get any bigger than Sam Kerr going down. It's a devastating blow, one that throws all of the season aspirations, all of the big targets into question now. Can they retain the WSL without her? I think it would be a fantastic achievement if they can. But you would say it's that road is looking tough. And given how difficult the Champions League has been for them in the last couple of years with Sam Kerr, it's hard to see them snatching that holy grail without her. It's just a huge, huge blow, and it's just brutal, man. ACL injuries in women's football, it's just absolutely brutal how common they seem to be, how difficult it is for the sport as a whole to get a handle on it, and how often it feels like massive names go down
for long stretches of time and miss major tournaments and miss key parts of seasons. And Sam Kerr's had a pretty good run health-wise at Chelsea until now. But this comes at a bad time for her with her future uncertain beyond this season as well, contractually. And I think any questions about January spending will have to be set against the knowledge that Emma Hayes will not be here beyond this season. And I think Paul Green probably will. And that maybe provides an element of continuity of decision-making. But, you know, even if you do decide to go out and try and get replacement, how do you go about replacing maybe the best number nine in world football, or certainly very close to it?
We've got to think of the human aspect as well, haven't we, Dom? From Sam's perspective, obviously it's massive for the team and for Emma Hayes, but this is so cruel on her after her World Cup was so diminished by injury as well. It's really been a rotten year for her in that respect.
Absolutely. And I know the Australians haven't qualified yet for the Olympics, but if they did, she'd miss that as well. So that's another tournament that would pass her by. I know she appeared later on in the World Cup, but that was meant to be her stage. She was meant to take that tournament by storm, and the injury denied her that as well. It's desperately, desperately cruel. It's difficult for her as well with her own contractual situation. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty around the place. It's desperately cruel for Emma Hayes as well. The chances of her going out on a high with Champions League success, as Liam has said, have been severely damaged, although she won't be thinking along those lines. She will just be concerned about Sam Kerr's welfare at the moment and getting her through this period of painful rehab that awaits. But yeah, on the ACL issue, that I'll point our listeners to an excellent piece that Sarah Shepherd wrote for us on the plethora of ACL injuries that are suffered in the women's game, and as Liam says, by key players as well. I think women are six times more likely to suffer ACL injuries than men in non-contact situations as well in games. It's absolutely staggering, and I think the science is still attempting to pinpoint why this happens, but it's well worth a read, and is linked on all the Sam Kerr news stories that are on the site at the moment.
Excellent. Athletic.com/ChelseaPod, the place to go to read those pieces. Well, to sign up if you're not currently a subscriber. Elsewhere in Chelsea news, the under-18s returned after their winter break on Saturday. They snatched a draw at Leicester thanks to Danelle McNeely's injury time equaliser, 2-2, the final score there. The under-21s back in action on Tuesday night. They host Valencia in the Premier League International Cup. Now that is just about going to do us for today then. Remember, if you would, to be so kind as leave us a nice review on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Hit the subscribe button as well. It helps us out, helps other Chelsea fans find the pod. We're going to be back on Thursday when we will reflect on what happened on Teesside on Tuesday, as well as looking ahead to the weekend Premier League game against Fulham, the return of the women's team to action, and plenty more besides. Until then, thanks to Liam, to Dom, and to Lucy for putting this all together, and to Jesse for popping on to tell us more about Sam Kerr as well, but mainly to you for listening. We wish you a good week. We'll speak to you later. Bye for now.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.